This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. The book is titled Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR. But that heading doesn't really do justice to a riveting tale within. As one reviewer put it, who knew that a tax historian could write so well? So if you want to talk taxes, have we got an hour for you. Their Fair Share author Joe Thorndike is with us, but we're planning to start with another man who knows a lot about Virginia taxes. Governor Bob McDonnell has agreed to take listener questions for the first few minutes of today's broadcast. Since we'll only have a short time with the governor, you might want to get your call to him in right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. Our conversations with Virginia's governor and then tax historian Joe Thorndike all get underway right after the news, and that call-in number to talk is 888-967-2825. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. We had planned to make taxes our primary focus this hour, basing our discussion on the new book written by tax historian Joe Thorndike. And Joe is here with us, set to offer many fascinating revelations, I'm sure. But we also managed to get a few minutes with Virginia's governor, Bob McDonnell. And he's agreed to talk with us about taxes or about anything you might want to ask him. But the governor can only be with us for just a few minutes. So if you want to talk with him, please call right now. 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Yes, we are in fundraiser mode, but this is not the number to call to give a contribution unless you consider talking a contribution. 888-WMRA-TALK, Governor Bob McDonnell, thank you so much for making time for us, sir.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on. Joe, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Well, so let's start with taxes. The new revenue plan for transportation approved by the General Assembly and that you have signed on to, Governor, is it fair to say that that will be a significant tax increase in Virginia?
There's no question this is going to raise some additional revenue, primarily Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. It'll amount to probably statewide to somewhere around $20 or less a person and truly a new revenues. Here's what I'll say. You know, over the last 3 years, we have done everything we can to try to find other sources of revenue with tax reform, with bonds, with surplus, with audits, a number of other things, offshore drilling, privatizing ABC. But the fact is that our maintenance deficits have gone to anywhere from $500 million in a couple of years, and it's because of the decline of the gas tax with inflation and alternative fuels and the CAFE standards. So this was the way we think we'll fix the transportation problem for more than a generation, and it's jobs, it's quality of life, and that's why I told the General Assembly, fix the problem this session. Don't leave here without getting it done. I introduced a bill. They modified it, and that's what I've got in front of me that I've amended.
This is the first time in, what, 27 years, Governor, that a new stream of revenue is coming into the state for transportation?
Is this sustainable and long-term. That's right, Tom.
This is your last year in office. Is this going to be your legacy, the first governor to have accomplished this in more than a generation?
Well, I'm going to let other people decide that. Look, I think we've done a lot on everything from our fiscal management to fixing our pension system to criminal justice reform, major higher education reforms, this session, dramatic K-12 reforms. We've done a number of things that I think make life in Virginia a little bit better. But clearly, this is one of the most intractable problems, 27 years without a reform in our transportation funding stream that's sustainable. And, of course, Northern Virginia being the most congested place in the country. Hampton Roads 20th, and really impacting our business ratings, our quality of life, quality time of kids and parents, and our ability to create jobs. So it's something that had to be fixed. Not everybody's going to like everything that we did to fix it, but I decided, look, it's good. I'm governor. Governors fix problems, and this is the best way we could get it done with a bipartisan General Assembly.
Governor, one of the more controversial, at least in terms of debate, issues in the General Assembly this past session was the proposal from Republicans to add a photo ID requirement to voter identification laws. Last year, if I remember correctly, you took that out. You amended the legislation, saying that you didn't think that was necessary. This year, you signed on to the photo ID. Did something change in your mind?
No, there was no change, and those reports are just Not correct. What we got last year was a ID bill that added the types of identification, but it was not photo. And secondly, it did away with the affidavit system if you didn't have an identification card, and required you to actually cast a provisional ballot and bring in subsequent proof. So there was not a photo ID bill last year that I received. I signed the bill last year with some amendments to it. I sent out voter ID cards to everybody, but this year the General Assembly decided to step up the scrutiny and add a photo ID bill. We didn't make any amendments to that this year. And because the bill also requires a free issuance of a photo identification card to anybody that doesn't have one and can't afford it. So I think it balances the need for fair and clean and free elections with the civil liberties and constitutional rights of an individual to have full access to the ballot box.
You've heard the arguments from the other side claiming that this is something Republican legislatures and Republican governors have been doing around the country because the people least likely to have a photo ID are poor and more likely to vote for Democrats. How do you respond to that kind of allegation?
Well, I really think that's a very irresponsible statement, because we've had an ID bill in Virginia for over a decade. That you had to bring an identification card to the polls. This one just changes it from a regular ID to a photo ID. And so we actually, this last election, had the fewest amount of provisional ballots we've ever had because of an identification card issue. People know that you need to bring an ID to the polls, and most people have a photo ID. I think 70% of people in Virginia support the photo ID concept. And now that we're making it available for free in the legislation, it's not going to impair anybody's civil liberties. As you know, I've been an advocate of getting everybody the ability to vote. I talk to young people about it all the time. I've restored more civil rights to convicted felons than anybody in Virginia history, because I want people to get back and engage in their democracy. So it's not that. It's about clean elections on the one hand, and about access to the ballot box, and there's nothing in this bill that is going to hurt anybody's right to vote. If you give them a free ID, I don't think anybody can say that they didn't have every opportunity.
Governor Bob McDonnell, most of the new federal health care laws provisions go fully into effect next year, including health insurance exchanges. What's going to happen with those exchanges in Virginia?
Well, I've already told the federal government we will not build a state-based exchange. We'll build a federal exchange. That's the default mechanism. Every state's got to have some kind of exchange. The only question is which type. We did not want to build a state-based exchange without the flexibility and then get stuck with the bill and the price tag. And so we've told the federal government if they can build one for Virginia. With regard to Medicaid expansion, which may be your next question, I don't believe we should expand Medicaid currently. We ought to have a good safety net. We ought to take care of the poor, blind, and aged and disabled, which we do now in Virginia. But expanding our rosters by 450,000 people at a time when Medicaid is already a budget buster, and by that I mean literally, it's 1,600% growth in 30 years, from 5% to 21% of the total budget. And so my position is we have to have dramatic and serious, longstanding reform of our Medicaid system to have more accountability and more cost savings before we can even consider expansion. And I think that's what the language in the budget does, is kind of create that firewall against expansion without reform.
Governor, are Democrats in the state Senate under the impression that they have a deal with you that would allow Medicaid expansion under the new federal law?
Well, they put some language into the budget that doesn't do what they think. There's some language in the budget that the House and Senate agreed to, Republicans and Democrats in the conference committee, that essentially says what I just said, and that is that it is a reform-first approach. And they added that to the conference committee to say that a subset of the General Assembly would determine whether or not reforms were actually being implemented and done and successful before there's any Medicaid reform. I mean, read a Medicaid expansion. So I think some are saying, well, we've clearly got a path to Medicaid expansion, but that would not be accurate, because it is a path towards dramatic, sustainable reform. I've made amendments to that section to be sure that there are even more significant reforms accomplished before the General Assembly approves this concept. And listen, the language in there is only good for a year in this budget, and then there'll be probably more debates about this concept next session. I'm just telling you, you know, as governor, we could have expanded Medicaid for the last year and a half, and we've decided not to do it because until reforms are done and the federal government gives us waivers, and I think there needs to be changes in the law, we got to be sure we don't contribute more to the national debt or Virginia's budget situation. So we have a long way to go, I think, before the reforms, I think, will be sufficient.
Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, I'm afraid we've already gone past the time your staff allotted us to speak with you, sir. But as always, it's great to talk with you. Thanks so very much for making some time for
us. Okay, Tom, great to be on Virginia Insights. Keep up the good show.
Take care.
Thank you.
So, very patiently waiting his turn here in the Insight studio, the author of the new book, Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR. Joe Thorndike, great to have you back on the Inside Airwaves.
Well, it's nice to be here again.
So, completely shifting from what we've just heard, and if you want to comment on anything that we just heard from the governor at some point, that would be fine. But I got to start with this question, Joe, because there are so many ramifications behind this issue. Do you know why we no longer have a special federal tax on underwear?
Well, we don't have a special federal tax on lots of little things that we used to have. We used to tax little items, consumer items, you know, chewing gum and soda, sugary sodas, and gold pens, and, you know, all these like weird little taxes. Some of them were luxury taxes, and some of them were just basically money grabs, raise a lot of money quickly. We got rid of most of those a long time ago because people didn't like them very much. They thought they were unfair. But a few of them still hang around, and you know and hate them now. It's things like the alcohol tax. That's the closest we come to things like that.
Much of the early part of your book, and you track history mostly from the years immediately before FDR came to office and then during the Depression and during the Roosevelt years at the White House. Although you also touch at the very beginning of the income tax in 1913. But in much of this early history of what was going on with taxes in the U.S. before pretty much everybody started paying income taxes, were these little excise taxes on what? Besides underwear, there was chewing gum and, as you mentioned, alcohol and tobacco, certainly.
Yep.
Part of the problem was that lots of people actually did not know that they were taxpayers.
Well, that's right, because an excise tax is often not collected from the taxpayer himself. You know, it's you don't pay it at the cash register. Instead, it gets paid by the person who's making this thing. And then it gets sort of built into the price of the good, and you don't really know that you've been taxed even. So, I mean, that was one of the big complaints about these taxes. They're not very visible. And in general, you want taxes to be visible. And they knew that back then, too. You want people to be aware of what they're paying. It breeds all sorts of good habits in people. If you know that your taxes are a certain amount and that they're getting bigger, you're going to be paying more attention to government and what government is doing and spending its money on. So if you're conservative and you think government's too big, you definitely want people to know what they're paying in taxes and to feel the pain directly. I personally think that this should be true on both sides of the political aisle, too, because, you know, the argument is how big should government be? And then the second argument is, OK, well, then how are we going to pay for it? You should win that first argument on its merits, whether you're a conservative or a liberal, whether you want smaller government or bigger government. So visibility is a good thing. It puts a price on government, or as the colorful phrase they used to use, the price on civilization. I think that excise taxes were not particularly good for that. Some are more visible than others. If you go pump gas at the station, you'll see a little sticker on the pump that'll tell you, you know, this gas is being taxed at X amount. But in general, we don't really know.
So to you who are listening, when was the last time you said to yourself, gee, if I only paid more in taxes, the world would be a better place? Can't quite remember. Well, you still might have some ideas on why taxes are the way they are, or some questions about that. Our call-in number is 888-WMRA-TALK. During the break, you'll hear a different phone number to give dollars. When we get back from the break, we'd like you to give your voice. on the subject of taxes as we continue our conversation with tax historian Joe Thorndike, 888-967-2825. Word is that when he was young, Joe Thorndike, Joseph J. Thorndike, once told his parents that he would never become a writer. He had watched his father's struggles as a journalist, including his dad's time as the editor of Life magazine. Today, Joe Thorndike serves as director of the Tax History Project, as a fellow of the George W. Bush Institute. And also, by the way, Joe's newest book is titled Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR. My name is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. If you want to talk taxes, we have a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer, you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. And on our Facebook page announcing today's show, Joe, we have a big picture of the cover of your book, Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR. And Skyler wrote in after looking at that cover and says, or asked this question, why is the word share in the title so big?
Well, you know, the answer to that is that authors have absolutely no control over what goes on the cover of their book, pretty much. So I can't really tell you why it was designed that way. But I will tell you that I think that those three words that make up the real title of the book are each of them just loaded with meaning, although not with any particular meaning. They're actually loaded with argument because in the 1930s and 40s, but really since we've had the income tax, 1913 on, and really even more than that. But since we've been taxing people, the question of their fair share has always been central to the whole enterprise. That in three ways, there's the their part of it. Well, who is this they that we're talking about? You know, is it everybody's share? Is it a rich person's share? Is it a poor person's, an average person's? So we argue a lot about who should be paying more or less. And that's the first question. And then how we define those people, assuming we all agree that they is rich people, then how rich is rich? When do you actually rich? That's been a big argument over the years too. Then there's the question of fair in a fair share. What's fair? Well, there really is no answer to this. I mean, this is, to put it straightforwardly, it's just it's a matter of opinion. And the only way that question really gets answered in a democracy is with a show of hands. That's not, in my mind, a really terrible thing. That is how we determine what's a fair share of taxes, is we take a vote, or we vote for people who are going to take a vote. But that has been, at the center of many tax arguments. And then this last word, share. Well, share of what? I mean, when we're talking about someone's fair share, does that mean their share of the total tax burden of all the money government is taking in? Because, for instance, the total share of revenue that's paid by rich people has been going up over time and in recent decades. Or do we mean a share of their income? Because in that case, what rich people have been paying has been going down in the last 30 years or so. So there's a lot of ambiguity in that. So the phrase, their fair share, means a lot and simultaneously nothing at all in particular. And that is what makes it a great thing to argue about. And it's why politicians have been using that particular phrase for 100 years to argue about taxes.
Skyler, you got us into a great topic. Thank you so much for that. Although apparently the answer specifically to your question about the word share on the title is that it was some artist who decided that, not the author. Joe, a few minutes ago, we were talking about excise taxes and emphasizing that there was a time in U.S. history, even for some decades after the income tax started in 1913, when much of the government's revenue, much of the money that came in for the federal government to spend, came from these excise taxes, primarily because the income tax for the first few decades was just on the very wealthy?
Yeah, it was a very narrow tax to start with. And the story of the income tax is of sort of gradual broadening and then a really quick broadening during World War II. But for a long time, it was never levied on, more than, say, 10% of the population. It grows a little bit bigger than that in World War I, and then it shrinks, and then it grows again. So it goes back and forth. But excise taxes were a way to tax people who were exempt from the income tax. Now, there were a lot of conservatives out there who would look at the income tax and they'd say, you know, this is class legislation. It is only targeting wealthy people, people who create jobs. That's what we would say today, you know, active producing people. And this is not good because that means there are a lot of freeloaders out there who aren't paying anything. And the liberal...
that sounds familiar.
It does sound familiar, doesn't it? We have the same arguments now that we did then. You'd think we could make progress, but we don't. But what would people would say then and what people still say now is, hey, these people don't pay income taxes, but they pay a lot of other taxes. Nowadays, we say, yeah, they're all paying Social Security taxes, which is true. Although you can argue about whether those are contributions or whether they're regular taxes. Back then, what they would say is, oh, yeah, these guys aren't paying income taxes, but they're paying plenty of excise taxes. Now,
and nobody knew exactly what the average man was paying in excise taxes, but the government's total take was huge in terms of percentage of its budget.
Well, like in the 30s, excise taxes were providing about half of all federal revenue up through the middle 30s.
So part of the discussion then was there were a lot of people, as you enumerate in your book, and there are a lot of colorful characters in this new book, Their Fair Share. I hope we'll get to talk about some of those personalities in just a few moments. But even people who had really sizable philosophical opposition to poor people paying excise taxes sort of just held their nose and said, well, the government gets a lot of money out of this. We need the money, so we can't really get rid of these?
Right. Well, so back then, there are all these crazy taxes on things like, you know, theater admissions or club dues or chewing gum or underwear or whatever, all the tiny little taxes that they levy for a variety of reasons, often because these things are a luxury and so, you know, no harm, no foul if we tax them. But a couple of excise taxes raised almost all the excise tax revenue, and they raised almost half of federal revenue. There were excise taxes on alcohol, including beer and liquor, and on tobacco in all its various forms, cigarettes and cigars and pipe tobacco and whatever. Between the two of them, tobacco and alcohol, these things were raising a lot of money. Now, they were very regressive. These take a much bigger share then and now of a poor person's income than they do of a rich person's income. And a lot of people looked at that then and now and said, that's just not fair. That's a regressive tax and that's bad. And that's true, but they were also providing so much money that they couldn't really just throw them out right away. So even the Roosevelt administration, no great fan of regressive taxes, tolerated these things for a long time, really all the way through, because they were so productive. It's also true that there's an element to excise taxes that makes them seem more fair to a lot of people. There's a choice involved. You don't have to buy tobacco or alcohol or anything else. You have a choice of how much you consume. So that seems inherently fair. Okay, they may be regressive in the sense that they take more from a poor person than a rich person as a share of their income. But that poor person doesn't have to buy it. So that's, you know, how bad do we feel for them really? And that, you know, I think that goes a long way to legitimizing these taxes for a lot of Americans in that period and even now.
Reading your book, I just had a hard time figuring that underwear was seen as a luxury, and so it was okay to tax it. But, you know, then it occurred to me that, yeah, I don't know, maybe in 1900, the thinking was most people made their own underwear, and so if you went to a store and bought some, that was a luxury.
Well, you know, some of it also is about definitions in that I think that some of the underwear taxes are taxes on women's lingerie, which is luxurious. And so the argument would go, well, we should tax, you know, silk lingerie as a luxury item. And maybe we don't tax as much cotton underwear, which would be utilitarian. The problem comes when you try to actually start writing these laws down and making those sorts of distinctions in the law. It becomes very complicated. So they tried to tax jewelry and they said, well, we're going to tax things that are made of gold and silver and that are carried on a person. And somebody else piped in after a while and said, you realize that you just taxed all the fountain pens, which they didn't mean to do. But it's hard to write the laws to get just what you want. That's one of the problems with excise taxes is that there are these definitional issues that are just nightmarish for the people actually trying to collect taxes.
To you on the other side of your radio, if you have an opinion about what you have heard so far or a question for our guest, you can join in by calling us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2828. 25, or post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. Author of Their Fair Share, tax historian Joe Thorndike is our guest. And Joe, we have this from Frank on our Facebook page who says, please talk some about why the United States does not have a national sales tax. Don't most other industrialized nations have one, even if they refer to it as a value-added tax?
Yes, that is quite true. And I think that you can mostly thank Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, personally for that fact. Roosevelt did not like the sales tax. Now, neither did most Democrats in that period, because, once again, seen as very regressive. There was the same argument about choice, you know, playing into this. People who chose to save more would not pay as much. But most economists then and now recognize that sales taxes were on their face regressive, and Roosevelt fought it. So, you know, time and again, this idea would get floated. They made a big effort in 1932, actually, right before Roosevelt takes office. And the Democrats actually kind of pushed the issue then. But it gets beaten down by rank-and-file Democrats because they think it's unfair. It comes up over and over. It was a live issue in the 20s, and it becomes a really live issue in the 40s during World War II, when suddenly they have to raise lots and lots of money very quickly to fight the war. And one of the main options that they considered was a sales tax. Roosevelt basically killed that almost single-handedly. He had the Treasury Department draft a memo that was called The Evils of the Sales Tax. And time and again, Roosevelt administration officials would say, this tax is not fair. And they carried the day. Instead, they decided to use the income tax more broadly and raise the money with that. I think what happened is that after the war, that was sort of the pattern was set, that we had this broad-based income tax that was going to provide most of our money, and we didn't need a sales tax. We'd had that argument. We had settled it. We didn't like it. It was regressive. Thank you, Franklin Roosevelt, very much. And that's the way it sticks for a long time. You know, we're having an argument now to some degree. We talk about a value-added tax. We talk about a national retail sales tax. But I think that the reason we don't have one is that for all those intervening decades, those politics established in the 30s and 40s, they were still, you know, shaping the way we lived our fiscal lives.
Let's talk about some of these colorful characters in your book, Joe, Their Fair Share. Real life characters, some of them in the book come across as larger than life, but probably early on we have to look at Andrew Mellon.
You know, Andrew Mellon is a really boring guy who's really interesting for the things that he did. There actually was a biography written of him, a good one a couple of years ago, but he's a difficult guy to write a biography about because his life was not very colorful on its face.
But one of my favorite lines in your book was it the journalist who was quoted as saying Andrew Mellon had three presidents serve under him?
Exactly. So
because he was Treasury Secretary throughout the 20s.
Yes.
Under three Republican presidents.
Right.
Although the idea was that maybe he ran things more than those presidents.
And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. So he started working for Harding. He worked all the way through the Coolidge years and into the Hoover years. He really was the guiding force of tax policy in the 1920s. He, I think, found a kindred spirit in Calvin Coolidge, who is also another hard-to-appreciate guy. He's kind of dull on his face, but has a large impact on the country in the period when he's in the White House. But the two of them really got together around the issue of tax reduction in the 20s and pushed through a major rollback in tax rates coming out of World War I. Now, coming out of any war, there's going to be a rollback in tax rates of some kind. And after World War I, pretty much everyone was agreed that we needed to reduce taxes by a lot. So certainly the Republicans in office then, Coolidge, Harding, whoever, deserve credit for making that happen. But it probably would have happened under almost any president at the time. But Mellon, who is one of the richest men in America and is a really prominent banker, has a plan on how to do this. And he manages to get that tax rate, which peaks at 77% during World War I, the top tax rate on personal income, to get that rolled all the way back to 25% by 1925. So that's a pretty dramatic change. I think Mellon is the architect of, you know, austerity on the one hand, of smaller government, smaller taxes, smaller spending. He gets a lot of credit for that. So does Calvin Coolidge, who I would like to say there's a new and good biography by a friend and colleague of mine, Amity Schles, that really looks at the Coolidge era and at Mellon and how they handle taxes in that period.
Huey Long comes up a few times in your book.
Yeah, and really couldn't be more different than Andrew Mellon. So if Andrew Mellon was drab and buttoned down and extremely conservative, Huey Long was a showman of the first order.
He has an influence on FDR's policies.
Oh, he's an extremely important figure, and he prompts Roosevelt to move to the left significantly in, say, like 1935. Roosevelt's about to run for re-election. Huey Long is a popular guy. And Roosevelt tries to sort of shore up his liberal credentials by proposing some very, very progressive tax reforms. Eventually enacted is called the wealth tax of 1935 because it is targeted specifically at really, really rich people. It raises income tax rates on those rich people, and it raises estate tax rates on those people. And the whole idea was to shift more of the tax burden to get away from these regressive consumption taxes, which we're going to tolerate because we can't figure out how not to tolerate them. But at least what we can do is ask the rich people to pay more. And this is the kind of bargain that the Roosevelt administration makes all the way through. We're going to ask a lot from regular people, from poor people, from middle class people. We're going to ask a lot. You're going to have to pay a lot. In exchange for that, I promise you that we will tax rich people even more. That's the FDR deal. And he makes it in the 30s, and then he really puts it in place in the 1940s. Huey Long I think Roosevelt would have gone a long way anyway in that direction, but Huey Long really makes sure it happens.
The book is titled Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR. Its author, Joe Thorndike, is our guest. If you want to talk to him, you can call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. I promise we're not going to ask you for money when you call that number. Yes, we've been giving out another number all day long, and you'll hear that again during the break because we do need your money. But if you call 888-WMRA-TALK, we're simply going to give you an opportunity to talk with our guest, Joe Thorndike. There's this fellow by the name of, I'm not even sure I'm going to pronounce this correctly, Joe, Ferdinand, is it Pecora?
Pecora, yep.
And it is because of him sort of inadvertently that we end up with a circus act in the halls of Congress at one point. But before we get to that part of the story, tell us about who Mr. Pecora was.
Well, you know, people will remember this from the last few years that we have this big crash on Wall Street and everybody calls out for an investigation. How did this happen? You know, how did AIG lose so much money and end up having us bail them out? And we did a big investigation or many investigations of that. Well, the same thing went on in the 30s. After the crash, a lot of people wanted to know what had happened and whose fault it was. So they start this big investigation in Congress, and this guy, Ferdinand Pecora, is put in charge of it. He's a lawyer.
He's chief counsel to the Senate Finance.
Banking Committee, I think
Senate
it was.
Banking Committee.
I'm not positive about that, but I think so. And he's just basically the staff director, but he's the guy asking the questions and designing the whole thing. And they hand it to him and say, look, go figure it out. And he hauls up all these people from Wall Street, all these really rich, prominent bankers, and puts them in the witness chair and grills them for days
and
days.
Really grills them.
Oh, it was
kind of thing that movies are made of and that some people were wishing would have happened on Capitol Hill over the past couple of years.
And people have actually harkened back to that Pecora era and said, why can't we have another Ferdinand Pecora out there to do this?
Well, there's a passage in your book that features Mr. Pecora and what leads to a circus act coming to town in Washington. And I'm going to ask you to read that when we continue. We are talking with tax historian Joe Thorndike about his new book, Their Fair Share, and our conversation will continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. So even though this year marks the 100th anniversary of the income tax, most of us don't generally feel like celebrating when the subject of taxes come up. But this book that we are discussing, Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR, is just so full of surprises, of fascinating characters, unsung heroes, and revelations about how America got the tax policies we have today that most of us have never heard before and probably have never imagined. Joe Thorndike is the author of this fascinating piece of literature, Fact based as it is, it sometimes does read like a novel. And Joe, could you read us the section that starts on page 83 about Mr. Pecora and his investigation, please?
Right. So this takes off from the idea that Democrats didn't have a new idea about taxes to save their lives at the time. They really didn't. They really weren't suggesting much. So here's where I take that off. If Democrats couldn't develop their own tax agenda, then someone was sure to do it for them. That person turned out to be Ferdinand Pecora, chief counsel for the Senate Banking Committee and tormentor of tax avoiders everywhere. June 1, 1933 was a bad day for J.P. Morgan Jr. Summoned to testify before a Senate committee, this scion of Wall Street's most fabled dynasty wilted visibly under the public scrutiny. For more than a week, he and his partners had been badgered by Pecora, whose prosecutorial style was good headline fodder. Eager to illuminate Wall Street's seamy underside, Pecora had grilled Morgan on his business practices during the first several days of testimony. Now the banker found events moving from bad to worse. Mesmerized by the humbling of Wall Street's gray eminence, reporters were having a field day. So, too, were hearing spectators who jammed the Senate caucus room in hopes of snaring a front-row seat. At least one member of the committee found the whole thing revolting. "We are only having a circus," complained Senator Carter Glass, Democrat of Virginia. "And the only thing lacking now are peanuts and colored lemonade." Charles Leaf, a publicity agent for Barnum & Bailey Circus, seized on Glass's comment. The next day, he appeared at the hearing with Lia Graff, a circus performer of, we'll say, very small stature. Leaf dropped Graff, who stood 27 inches tall, in Morgan's lap, setting the stage for one brief conversation and countless famous photographs of the, quote, "the millionaire and the midget." Graff and Morgan appeared together on the front pages of newspapers across the country. It was a low point for Wall Street's most famous private banker, who found himself reduced to a public spectacle. The Great House of Morgan, established by Jack Morgan's imperious father, had seldom been the subject of scrutiny, much less ridicule. But the Pecora investigation had brought many embarrassments to the firm, not the least of which concerned Morgan's personal tax returns.
Former columnist for Bloomberg.com, current director of the Tax History Project, Joe Thorndike is our guest. His new book about the history of taxes in America is titled Their Fair Share. Who knew that a book about tax history could be absolutely fascinating? What happens to Mr. Morgan after this particular hearing is not pleasant, but it is sort of a lesson for society in terms of tax avoidance and tax evasion?
I think so. You know, this question of tax avoidance, particularly by people who are wealthy, has always been really at the center of tax policy in the 20th century and now into the 21st, because it can outrage people very easily. So it's a good way to whip up some anger and then use that to push through some reforms. You know, if this sounds like arguments about the Buffett rule in these years of the Obama administration, it should, because it's much the same sort of thing going on, although Buffett is a sympathetic character in our current narrative, but there are plenty of less sympathetic ones. Well, in the 30s, there was a real tendency to try to personalize the failings of the tax system. And for Morgan, that meant that they were going to take a look at the loss deductions that he claimed. So the issue here was that Morgan didn't pay any income taxes in the first couple of years of the Great Depression, which was outraging people, because here's this really, really rich guy not paying any taxes at all. You hear that kind of talk nowadays. Well, I mean, there were actually good reasons why Morgan hadn't paid anything. He had lost an enormous amount of money in the crash on Wall Street, and he was deducting those losses against whatever income he had, and he didn't end up with any income left to tax. That's the way the tax laws were written. It was actually legal. He didn't do anything wrong. But on its face, it seemed really unfair, especially while there was so much suffering going on in the country. And so Democrats seized on that to try to get people angry and to change the tax laws. It didn't change them dramatically right afterwards, but it was the beginning of a process that continued for a while. Now, the person who really pushed Pecora on and egged him on and encouraged him to do all of this and to be so hard on these bankers was Franklin Roosevelt, because Roosevelt understood if you can personalize a tax policy, if you can demonize a rich person, you can do a lot of what you want to do. So a lot of the progressive tax reforms in the 1930s are built on this personalization of tax policy. Roosevelt was always looking for dirt on rich people. There's a really...
I laugh, but actually that's a very serious remark, isn't
well,
it?
No, I mean, I'm not defending this in Roosevelt. This is just a statement of fact. You don't have to like it, but this is what Roosevelt did. And you may like the way, what comes out of it, you may not, but he understood that this was effective politics. So at one point they go to the Treasury Department and they say, look, we want some studies on rich people and the taxes they're paying. And the Treasury Department does a whole bunch of studies. They, like, you know, gather up all the data and they say, well, the top 1% are paying this or whatever, you know, and they come up with a lot of dry numbers. But then they go back and they say, you know, give us some names. Like, who are you thinking of when you're mad that these people aren't paying enough? Just throw out some names. And they throw out basically a bunch of movie stars and rich old families like the Vanderbilts and
Douglas Fairbanks,
captains of industry, you know, and they just basically walked around the White House and said, well, who do you want us to look at? And they picked out these names. They called it wealth by reputation and looked at what they were paying in taxes. Now, that stuff wasn't made public at the time, but other pieces of information like that were pushed into the public sphere later on in the 30s.
So to you who are listening, there have been a number of national surveys where a significant number of Americans seem to be saying something along the lines of, well, taxes for me are not all that out of line, but that guy over there, he does not pay nearly enough. Does that describe your view? Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. I know you get asked to do this at dinner parties all the time, Joe Thorndike, but let me ask you here. Can you give us your encapsulated history of the income tax in America?
I don't know if it's encapsulated enough, but I'll give it a shot. You know, I'll start by saying that the animating question here, it's 100 years. Well, why do we care about that? And do we have any time left with this income tax? And I think that the short answer to that is that this tax is still doing a pretty decent job of the two things a tax actually has to do. It has to raise money, and it has to strike people as relatively fair. We can complain all we want about it and say we don't like it, it doesn't work well, it's too complicated or whatever, but compared to the alternatives, it seems to be reasonably fair. What is it that Churchill said about democracy? It's the worst form of government known to man except all the others. Well, it's sort of the same thing about that. That's the status of the income tax. But it comes out in the early 90s. You know, we had a little income tax, a big income tax, actually, in the Civil War. They use it for a couple of years. They let it expire at the end of the war because it's very unpopular. It doesn't go away. People keep arguing about it. People keep suggesting that they bring it back. It's a good way to tax rich people. So it's a very popular idea in certain quarters. And by the 19-teens, they've got some momentum behind this. And they actually push through a constitutional amendment to make sure they had the authority to do it. And they enact this tax. It's designed to make the system more progressive. Up until that point, almost all money had been coming from tariffs and excise duties. That's both two regressive taxes. And they really want to make it fairer and more progressive. So they create the income tax targeting just rich people to try to balance the scales of justice. And they end up with this little tiny tax. Then the story becomes, as it always is in tax history, one about wars. Wars are what change taxes in this country. So World War I comes along. They need a lot of money really quickly. They say, hey, look at this new tax we've got over here, this income tax. It's working pretty well on these rich people. Maybe we should make it a little bit bigger and raise the rates. And they do, and it raises lots of money. That's the first big change in the tax, in the income tax. In the 20s, the rates go down because rates go down after wars usually. And then in the 30s, they start to creep back up in the face of large deficits. But the next really big change comes in another war. World War II comes along, and Franklin Roosevelt says, wow, we got to raise a lot of money really quickly. What are we going to do? Well, we got this tax on rich people. It works pretty well. Let's raise the rates. Let's make it a little broader. And that's exactly what they do. They choose not to do a sales tax. They do this instead. They raise the rates dramatically. The rates go up, you know, to 94% in 1943 or 44. And more important than that, they lower exemptions, which means that they just ask lots of middle-class people who had been exempt from the tax totally before to pay this tax for the first time. So as the saying goes, it goes from being a class tax to a mass tax. This is the most important change that goes on in the history of the income tax in its whole stretch. And it's the reason I chose to write the book that I actually wrote, because The tax system we have today is pretty much the same system that they created in the 1940s. It's been changed a lot around the edges and in some important ways as well as minor ways, but it is basically the same system. It's an income tax paid by a big chunk of Americans. Now, there are people who don't actually pay, right? We're familiar with the 47% of Romney fame. That issue of non-payers has been around since the beginning as well. But fundamentally, most people are paying this tax, at least filing returns, although some people are getting refunds now, you know, because they may qualify for things like the EITC. But that tax lasts all the way through the post-war years. You have a Republican in the White House for the 1950s and a Republican Congress for a few years in there. They leave the tax rates unchanged, essentially. They leave the income tax unchanged. Rates start to come down in the 60s and the 70s, and then really a lot in the 80s. Still basically the same tax. It's made more rational. It's made more functional, but it's not really changed at all. And now what we have is we've had a tax that has lasted a long time. And, you know, in the 80s, it had gotten to the point where it was a little unwieldy, and they did this big tax reform in 1986 to lower the rates a lot and get rid of a lot of loopholes. We may be at that sort of a point again, because any tax that's 100 years old or even just dating from, World War II is more than half a century old. It's getting pretty creaky. It may need that sort of wholesale reform again, but I, for one, don't really see it happening too soon, because if there's an iron law of tax politics, it's that taxes change when they have to, not when they should. And I don't think that there's a have to. I don't think that there really is anything that is so completely non-functional that lawmakers are going to do the hard work of really changing the tax system. We might reform it. We might add little new taxes here and there. But this basic income tax, which we all run, file on April 15th in just a couple of weeks, I don't think that's going anywhere, because it's still doing those two things. It's still raising a lot of money. It's still striking people as reasonably fair until it really fails on one of those things. And I think it'll fail on the raising enough money side of things. Until it does that, I think lawmakers will kick the can down the road as long as they can.
888-WMRA Talk, our phone number. Tax historian Joe Thorndike, our guest. Next to Woodstock, Bruce, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, I'm interested if a flat tax has ever been seriously considered historically, and if so, what the arguments pro and con were, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Bruce.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and the answer is yes. Especially in the beginning, there was a lot of debate about whether graduated rates, made any sense, or whether they were fair, or whether they might in fact be socialistic, because they were so clearly targeting rich people or well-off people or just whatever. So there was a lot of debate. Some people said, you got to have either just one rate or none at all, because it's just not fair to make these arbitrary distinctions.
When you say they were targeting rich people, what you mean is that when they didn't have a flat tax, they were targeting rich people?
Well, and since 1913, there have been graduated rates. We've always had them. But there was argument at the time that said, really, we shouldn't do this, because you're drawing arbitrary lines between groups of people. And why should we tax somebody making $300,000 a year more than $100,000? Why not $325,000? Why isn't that the threshold? Why isn't $400,000 or $275,000?
So this was even before it was a mass tax. This was when basically only wealthy were paying, but
right.
The rates were different depending on how wealthy you were.
Right. And we had a bunch of brackets that ranged all over the place. Now, today we have, I think, 6 brackets. Maybe we've added a 7th. In any case, we used to have more like 30 or 40 brackets, because we thought it made sense to draw these lines between groups of people based on how much income they had, and that we could tax them differently based on that. But a lot of people have always felt that that was arbitrary. So there has been talk about a flat rate tax, although it's worth pointing out that even a flat tax is actually not totally flat, because there's this big there's an exemption. There's some amount of income that's not taxed at all. That's a zero rate. And since we all pay the zero rate up to our exemption level, if you do the math, there's actually a slope in that line. So what it means is that poor people don't pay anything. They're paying zero. And super rich people would pay pretty much what the top rate would be, that single rate. Let's call it 25%. But in the middle, everybody else is going to be paying something between 0 and 25%. So there is some graduation. There's progressivity even in a flat tax. But it does get rid of a lot of these difficult issues about how to draw the rate structure, and which are admittedly arbitrary. But a liberal's response to be would be that's arbitrary to not have those graduations. You know, this is not an argument that's ever going to be settled by economists. They don't have an answer for what's the right rate structure.
It is so remarkable in this book of looking at 100 years of the income tax that the arguments being made back in the 19-teens, 1920s, 1930s are essentially the same discussions we're having today. We've got less than a minute left, Joe Thorndike. If you were able to recommend a change in tax policy, if we didn't have to wait until, as you said, it has to change when it should change, do you have a sense of what should change now?
I think that in general, Americans are interested in having more government than they're interested in paying for, and that that's not sustainable over the long run. So I think the argument to have here is how big should government be? And then we should all agree that we're going to pay for whatever the answer is. So for me, I think a value-added tax is probably a necessary thing to pay for entitlements that people like Medicare and Social Security. But we'll have to see.
Our guest has been tax policy historian, fellow at the George W. Bush Institute, and director of the Tax History Project, Joseph J. Thorndike. Once again, his new book is titled Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR. Joe, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. If you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work Dr. Thorndike is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.